Many newspapers have called it the greatest club game ever. The strength of Munster rugby has always been the big boys up front.
I'm actually really, really excited for it.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the rugby channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
John Duggan is with us in studio at 8:41. How are you, John?
Good, Owen, and Jerry's halves.
Yeah, good. There's plenty happening. There's a good eclectic mix of stories in the back pages there. What are you looking at? What's leading the agenda for you?
What's leading the agenda is obviously this nuclear war now between the Irish Rugby Football Union and the women's rugby players. 62 of them writing to the government, effectively asking them to intervene about how the sport's run in the country. Rock bottom for relations between the bodies. 2014, fourth in the world. 2013, Six Nations Grand Slam, to a situation where they're losing to Spain and not qualifying for World Cup. The Sevens game, they didn't qualify for the Olympics. Should there even be a Sevens programme? Are there enough of a pool of players for that to even happen? And the RFU responding with their own statement, which has been criticised in some quarters. They criticised the tenor and timing of this communique from the players to the government when there are two independent reviews going on into A, the World Cup failure, B, the way the sport is run in the country. The issue I have with that is that these reviews are being commissioned by the RFU. They see the reviews and they don't have to publish them, and they will not be publishing them. They're only going to publish key findings. It feels that the breakdown of relations has got to such a Cold War situation that for the players to go to the government and bring Catherine Martin and Jack Chambers into this, who are obviously now jumping all over it, having given the RFU 18 million euro in grant money yesterday, as taxpayers' money, it has really got to a stage where this is really stark for the RFU, who have to be called in now to explain themselves about how they're running the game. To me, what's the pathway? And it doesn't seem that there is a transparent pathway about the running of the women's game from what the players have said.
Does it kind of speak to maybe a wider problem in the organisation? Even does it have to come to a point where these reports, regardless of whether it's the men's or the women's game, just need to be published, and that is kind of like a first step? Because in fairness, and I know we've spoken a lot about this on the show, Ger, as well, that when you get to the every 4 years review of why Ireland got knocked out in a World Cup quarterfinal in the men's game, there is a report that is carried out but isn't fully published. Does that need to change? Is that one of the first things that needs to change here, that when there's work carried out to find out the failings in the men's or the women's game, that actually the public know about it? Because, as you say, John, there's now a bit of extra taxpayers' money going into this organisation.
Maybe don't fail.
A failure-free zone
Maybe put better plans in place so you don't have to analyse why your plans got screwed up in the first place. Mm. Would that not be... Sorry, John, go on ahead. Give us your thoughts on that, because I just
came into my head, do we need an ombudsman or woman for sport in the country if there's taxpayers' money going to these organisations? Like Irish boxing, for example, is a sport that has had serious issues around the smoothness of its governance, you'd have to say, in recent times. The way GA money is spent, for example, on developments like Porky Cueve. The accountability around that, if there's 30 million going to it. Do we need some kind of independent, function of the state to almost do a sweep of organisations around what they're doing if they're taking public funds, including horse racing, greyhound racing, all that kind of thing, from a transparency point of view? That might not be a bad thing.
Isn't that, I would argue, Sport Ireland's function? And maybe we need to beef up the statutory powers of Sport Ireland.
Yeah.
And if you're getting any grant money, then you need to sign up. But I made this point a little bit earlier on. The IRFU have singularly failed to reach the number of women, the gender quotas that were outlined, that they signed up to and agreed to. The last figures that I've seen were from March, and they were at 8% at that point. Maybe they've hit the 30% in the intervening 8 months, but it certainly doesn't seem like they have, because none of the actions over the last period of time suggests an organisation that understands the role of the growth potential for the women's game, how women are supposed to be treated within the sport. It just seems like it's an organisation that just doesn't really fully understand what's happened to it. And it's interesting too, this is a huge moment for them. Philip Brown's supposed to finish up in 2 weeks' time. This is his Christmas holidays must be due to kick in fairly soon. And this is going to be the very end of his time in charge of the IRFU. So I don't know who the new CEO is going to be, or who the acting CEO is going to be, or what the role is at that point. But like, a you know, big opportunity for whoever comes in to usher in a clean sweep and a new broom. But I think you're dead right, John. Somebody needs to be fully holding these organizations to account because of the amount of public money that they get. And that's the key thing.
Remember the Billy Walsh case? One of our greatest ever coaches was let go to go to the United States, and Sport Ireland and I think the state, they all wanted to give him a deal, and it just, the politics of it didn't work out. I remember calling it leprechaunism at the time. And I remember Sport Ireland, I think they said that their confidence was shaken in the administration of boxing. But what actually happened after that? Nothing.
And to be honest, like I do wonder as well, like, and I kind
because
of,
you always get this argument, oh, you're hurting the sports people if you take away funding.
And sometimes I think that success can cover up those sort of failings as well. Like, you'd have to say that the Tokyo Games were much more successful. Well, there's no question about it. It is a fact that the Tokyo Games were a much more successful Olympics for Irish boxing than Rio was. So there could be a picture painted in the aftermath of that, you know, everything's on the right track, everything has been sorted. The Billy Walsh scandal, remember that? Yeah, everything is fixed since then. And of course, things have got better, but have things actually been mended properly? Have things been done in all the right ways since then? And I think that looking at the medals and looking at the success is the wrong way to do that. And that kind of made me be a little bit hesitant to compare the IRFU even to maybe the women's football team here at the moment, because yes, they're on a successful run at the moment, but just because the visible part of the duck is tranquil and everything is going quite well doesn't mean that what's going on under the surface is going very well either. And unfortunately, from Irish rugby's perspective, it has been the performances on the pitch that have sparked this series of events that have allowed everybody to look a little bit deeper under the surface. And I wonder, over a period of time, in a perverse way, will people be thankful that actually the bad results happened and that actually it forced a real rethink about how women's rugby was operating in this country?
Well, rightly now, there's much more attention and scrutiny and care given to women's sport, because if you look at the Sportswoman of the Year Awards this week, it's been the year of the woman because gender really shouldn't be relevant. But like, all the main achievements in Irish sport this year have been from women. Kelly Harrington, Leon Maguire, Ellen Keane, Rachel Blackmore, the Meath ladies. You go on and on. And we're giving more coverage to the women's soccer team. Sky are sponsoring them. Cadbury's are sponsoring them. They're seen as a great brand. Thankfully, it seems Stephen Kenny will get a contract, because we know that the men's team is actually a good brand right now. So I do think, like, from tracksuit gate to there, you can see what can happen in a good way. And hopefully whoever's coming in the RFU, CEO-wise, can bring the women's game from this nuclear standoff to a better place where there's a pathway. How do we get more people into the pool? Is it through? Do we need a better AIL? What's the situation with the provinces? And can we get these girls to be playing more games? Because, go into World Cups, even though there might be a lot of funding, there might be a lot of support around the actual tournament itself, what is the day-to-day and the week-to-week so they can improve their skills and be competitive again vis-a-vis England and France?
Can we talk to John about Lewis Hamilton? Because there's a culture war ongoing in the OTB AM team here. Owen thinks what happened at the weekend was brilliant, great TV, high drama, that's amazing, that's all you want of a Sunday afternoon, sitting eating your popcorn and
arguably fair,
and getting fair. High on the sugar. And I'm making the point that, like, it's a shit show.
Well, let's hear what Lewis Hamilton said on the final lap of that race. And let's hear now what Max Verstappen said yesterday.
Of course, it helps that you already have 7 titles. I think that comforts him a bit. Yeah, it would have. I think if it's the other way around, it would be more painful, you know, for me, because I didn't have one. So, but you know, Lewis is a great sportsman in general. He came up to me and congratulated me, and it must have been, of course, you know, very tough in that last lap. But yeah, it also shows the respect, you know, we have for each other in general. Of course, we had our tough times throughout the season, but at the end, you know, we respect what we were doing, and we were pushing each other to the limit the whole season. So it has been really enjoyable, you know, racing against him.
It was fantastic entertainment, but I feel that Lewis Hamilton is the most unlucky person I've ever seen in sport. He was the best driver in Abu Dhabi. And you could know that from the very first moment of the race, when he outsmarted Verstappen and had a better start than Verstappen. off the grid when he wasn't first. He's 12 seconds ahead of Verstappen. How is it fair when he's got the race in the bag that he can't change tyres, that Verstappen can change tyres and be right behind him, and then Lewis Hamilton's a sitting duck when all the back markers between them were allowed to unlap, but the rest of the cars weren't allowed to unlap? Because if that had happened, the safety car would have just taken it to the end. It is a wacky racist solution that even Dastardly and Muttley could not have dreamed of.
Dastardly and Muttley, Owen?
Oh, I'm a big fan of Dastardly and Muttley. They used to be on TG Cahir in the early 2000s.
It's the Netflixization of sport. You cannot argue it's the most dramatic entertainment things I've ever seen in sport, but I don't know about the fairness of it. And that's why I look at sport. I'm a 1-0 to the Arsenal kind of guy. I'm into the rules. And to me, this seems too cloudy.
You see that? There you go. It is cloudy. That is it. Nobody can tell me for sure that what happened to Lewis Hamilton was a complete travesty of justice and that he has been properly thrown under the bus
like
of
one.
Entertainment here. It kind of feels like one.
But it feeling like one is not good enough. It's not acceptable for it to feel like that. It doesn't. It's not right. Lewis Hamilton, everything went against him. And to be like, I don't blame Max Verstappen or Christian Horner. They were just doing what they were told. But every single thing went against Lewis Hamilton. That doesn't seem right. How can you be 12 seconds ahead to have the guy right behind you for one lap of like a black ball finish where the referee puts the black ball on the spot and says, okay, lads, forget about what's ever happened before? It just seems to me it's Netflixization.
Next goal winner, that was a great one. Somebody said it's like 4-0, 89 minutes on the clock, and then the ref picks up the ball and goes, next goal winner. You're like, all right, cool. I mean, you know.
Like everybody knows, like this, the drive to survive is going to be absolutely sensational, and everybody will be. They've done an amazing job in that regard. But I just, why couldn't they just let the race come out to the end with the safety car to the end, and let it finish that way? Because I think that would have been a fair outcome.
It would have been embarrassing for them.
Well, how would it be embarrassing?
Because everybody's watching and everybody's like, hang on, can you? Here's the thing. This is an organization who, during the year, got everybody to go to Spa. The rains came and then they were like, oh no, that was a race. Even though we only had 3 laps, you can't have your money back. Like, this is not like a paradigm of well-run sporting goodness. This is as weird and dysfunctional multinational sports organization as FIFA, as UEFA, as the IOC. This is their moment to shine. Sports administrators screwing up and shining, and everybody finally is like, oh, because what happened in Spa was just like just as egregious, right? I can't even remember, but Shane would tell us.
Yeah.
Points were awarded on the basis of that race. Doesn't make any sense. And I think it would have been embarrassing for the sport, for people, the new watchers on who don't tune in all the time, going, why did the safety car come in? How does the race over behind the little Mercedes just won the whole thing?
Because it would have been sporting rules correctly applied.
Sure, but like I think that everybody would have gone, these rules don't make any sense, and I think what they were trying to do is to prevent the embarrassment. What they did was they applied rules that nobody seems to fully understand, that are totally opaque, and as a result, everybody's going, what the hell is this?
All I know is that there was a very black and white rule in there, and that is that the race director can do what the hell he likes. And the race director did what the hell he liked on Sunday. So the rules have been applied by, and entertainment has come to the fore as well. It's a win-win-win. I see absolutely nothing wrong with this. The game stay the game.
There's about 100 memes going through my head at the moment. It's like your man in Inspector Gadget with the cat that you never see. That's just deciding everything. And the other one was going through my head was Trading Places. I don't know if you ever seen that movie, Trading Places, with Eddie Murphy. And
is Trading Places a Christmas movie?
It is, with Dan Aykroyd and
controversial take.
And Eddie Murphy, where your man is going at the end, Mortimer. He's one of the dukes, and they've been done out of all their money. He's just going, bring those brokers back in here, turn those machines back on. And it's like, that's what like Toto Wolff was like. Don't, Michael, no. And it was a bit like that. And they can't go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Apparently, the only people they can appeal to is an independent FIA panel. So that's what's going to happen now. Samuel is writing about that today in the Mail. And what's going to happen now is, I think, like, to be fair, Lewis Hamilton was brilliant after the race. He was such class. And then Max Verstappen says correctly that if you won 7 world titles, it helps. But it actually will motivate Lewis Hamilton. If I was Lewis Hamilton, I'd be so gunning for next year to win that 8th world title. And that will bring the entertainment value back to next
year. Win-win-win.
Yeah.
Almost right.
For sure. John Duggan.
All right, lads.
Great stuff this morning. Thanks, Minnie, for being with us. Quarter past nine, you're very welcome back. It is time to turn our attention back to the Formula One, and we're going to touch on the Premier League in just a moment as well, because Shane Hannan has been stewing on his hot take for 48 hours almost. How are you, Shane?
Morning, lads. How are things?
How angry are you?
I don't know if angry is the word. Like, when it was all going down on lap 58, I was jumping up and down like everyone else. I think even the most fervent Formula One fan was probably a little bit confused as to what was happening. Like, just one of those moments. It was like a couple of years ago during the World Snooker Championship semi-finals, there was two games that had me off my feet, jumping up and down at how crazy it was. It was the same for that final lap. You can call it sport, you can call it entertainment. It was probably a little bit of both, let's be honest. But what ensued, I'm still confused about it. So, like, if I try and explain it to people in as simple a way as I can, like, the moment Verstappen comes into the pits for new hard tyres during the virtual safety car earlier in the race, Hamilton didn't. Now, Red Bull are in this position that they can do whatever Hamilton doesn't do because they're in the lead in the championship. All they need to do is finish ahead of him, and they've won. So they can watch what Mercedes and Hamilton do and do the exact opposite. Now, Verstappen made up a decent chunk of time when he moved to those hard tyres, but then kind of times began to fade away. It was clear that Hamilton was going to go on and win this race. Didn't have enough to close the gap. Then the next Nicholas Latifi crash happens with under six laps left. Safety car comes out. The entire strategy attempt number two by Red Bull, they figure, right, we'll do whatever Mercedes don't do. So that stacked up the field, the safety car coming out, of course. We're used to seeing that. The safety car comes out, the field gets stacked, the cars come closer together, and Verstappen comes into the pits for soft tyres. So there were questions then about whether the race would restart from the grid, but Verstappen had nothing to lose at this stage. So it didn't matter whether Verstappen was running in second or 12th if the race had restarted, as different journalists are pointing out. The point was, Hamilton stayed out. So he was expressing a concern about his tyres during this time. This is the brilliant thing about Formula One. I know you lads have talked about it already this morning. The entertainment level and what you can hear on the radios is quite extraordinary. But what unfolded with Verstappen taking these new tyres, the race did restart. We didn't know if it was going to restart. We didn't know if the race was going to end on the safety car.
Can I ask Shane, sorry to interrupt, as somebody who doesn't understand, why did Hamilton not get his tyres changed? What would have happened?
Well, essentially Hamilton wasn't sure whether the race was going to restart or not. Nobody was sure. But Verstappen, you see, Mercedes had to make the call. So they decided, right, we don't know if this race is going to restart. If we pit and we go into the pits and get new tyres, Verstappen will be ahead of us. There is no doubt about that. So Red Bull could make that decision easily because they're already losing the race. I mean, they're coming second. As I said, if Verstappen comes 12th or second, it doesn't matter. He's lost the world championship. So pitting was an easy decision for Red Bull. For Mercedes, they're thinking in their heads, okay, this is a risk because if the race doesn't restart, if this stays under the safety car, which we've seen happen before, and you mentioned Spa. Like, I was there when the farce happened and the race was given, half points were given out because the race technically finished under a safety car. I thought that was going to happen. I actually was watching the end of the race on Sunday afternoon, and I was thinking this safety car will be there until the checkered flag. Hamilton will be champion, and that's it. So Red Bull made the decision to pit, you know, assuming that might happen also. There's nothing to lose for them here. Look, it doesn't change the controversial aspect of what happened. Verstappen had the advantage. He can do whatever Mercedes doesn't do. If Hamilton had pit on either occasions where the Red Bull of Verstappen pitted, he would have been behind. So I don't think either team could have made a different decision. That's the complicated nature of it. But this is something that we're going to be talking about for decades to come, it has to be said.
It will surely lead to a new rule being written in, right? Where they will say that if there is less than two laps remaining in the race, we cannot finish this thing behind a safety car. Is that just what needs to get written into the rule book here? Because the thing is, from what you're saying there, had Mercedes know what was going to happen, they obviously would have pitted Hamilton, right?
Yeah, but this is the thing, Owen, as well. Like, we talk about the rule book, but a lot of people are reading into, and a lot of people who have been following Formula One for much longer than me have been reading into this rule book and looking into the FIA regulations, and still are unsure whether Michael Massey made the correct call here. Like, he's the man with his finger on the red button towards the end of the race. He decides whether these lapped cars can overtake the safety car and which lapped cars can overtake the safety car. He's the one who made the point. He's like like John was speaking there about the Netflixization of sport, and I see what he means by that. But, like, at the end of the day, Michael Massey is he's like the cousin Greg. He's the attack dog of Formula One. He's like he is the person who is probably has just brought so many more hundreds of thousands of viewers to Formula One for next year.
Are we sure it's not Tom Wamsgams here a little bit?
I think cousin Greg lost 750 million. That's not great.
Well, that's true. But like he's the guy who has to bring more fans into Formula One. Now, whether or not he made that decision because of those reasons on Sunday, we will never know. The fact of the matter is, lads, and this is something that people are forgetting. Yes, Lewis Hamilton looked the stronger racer on Sunday afternoon, but realistically, Max Verstappen, you know, qualified on pole. He had most poles throughout the year. He had the most podiums throughout the year. He had the most points clearly throughout the year. He had a P9 in Hungary earlier in the season, but besides that race, he finished in the top two in every single race across the season. He was the most consistent driver across the year. So you cannot question his deserving of winning this world title. Now, Lewis Hamilton will be back, of course, next year. But really, Hamilton, like, look, he led 51 of the first 57 laps. So, of course, you're going to feel for the man. But really, Max Verstappen is a deserving champion. And I think Lewis Hamilton's quiet nature that you mentioned earlier, Owen, after the race, probably hints at that. Like, on the podium, he was quite quiet. He sat in the car, didn't say anything. Some people suggested that's because he was waiting for these investigations to come through and Mercedes to do their thing with the FIA. But really, I think he just accepts the fact that he can't fault Max Verstappen winning this. Piers Morgan tweeting.
Oh, he's there. You're
robbed
back
by rule-bending officials. It's a joke. But like, look, this is what the British media do anyway. Lewis Hamilton is a fantastic champion. And he's gained a lot of fans probably since the weekend even as well. But you can't take it away from Max Verstappen.
In fairness, the sitting in the car thing, like, I can relate with that. Like, I sometimes just drive home and just sit in the car for a while and I'm just too lazy to get out of the car. I'm just too tired. I just want to sit here for a few more minutes, to be quite honest with you. So I can completely appreciate that. Shane, why do you think everybody hates entertainment so much? Well, like, why have people become so lacking in fun and lacking in joy that they've started to question whether or not entertainment's a good thing?
This is the thing. I think people, the real fervent sports fans, think, and ones who maybe tuned in for the first time for Formula One in a long time at the weekend, they just had a sour taste in their mouths. They thought, this isn't sport, but this has always been Formula One. This is what happens. Crazy things happen. The FIA make decisions that eventually determine and ultimately determine the outcome of races. That's just what the sport is. They have to do something. Someone in that room, with Michael Massey in that room, has to make a decision, and it has to be a split second decision. You feel for the guy, because I looked at a poll yesterday on Twitter, and someone, a Formula One journalist, there was maybe 1,000 replies to this poll, asked, what would you have done? What do you think was the right decision? And the four options, I can't remember the exact four options, but one was Michael Massey made the right call. One was the race should have been restarted, red flagged and restarted from the grid and the final lap or two finished that way. Some people felt like the lap cars shouldn't have been allowed to overtake the safety cars. Of the options, there was essentially an even split between the four options. And like, so Michael Massey had a split second or, you know, maybe 30 seconds to make a call that on a Twitter poll among 1,000 people was fairly evenly split. I still think it was a controversial end, and it will be talked about for some time to come. And I don't know what the right call was. I feel bad for Lewis Hamilton, but at the same time, Mercedes had a couple of bad calls potentially during the race, but hindsight's 2020, and Max Verstappen overtook him on the final lap, as you said as well, Ger. So
yeah,
really, it does leave a bad taste in the mouth, but at the end of the day, it is what it is. That's the sport.
Yeah, and it were. It's entertainment, as Owen wants. Can I ask you about what happens next in terms of that rivalry? I'm just Googling the age there. Lewis Hamilton's 36, and he has kind of hinted in the past that he might finish a little bit earlier than maybe expected. Schumacher retired, I think, at 38 for the first time, and then came back 3 years later and did another couple of seasons. So what's realistic for him to continue over the next few seasons and to build this rivalry and to take the sport to the crescendo that it seems like it's trending towards?
Yeah, like Hamilton, even in advance of the last race there, was asked about the eighth world title and was he focused on winning this eighth world title and beating Michael Schumacher's record? And he was saying, you know, it doesn't interest me, I haven't really thought about it, but that we all know that's a lie. He's sitting on seven with Schumacher now. Schumacher, you know, his hero, essentially. Of course he wants to overtake him. He's not going to quit until he gets another 2 or 3 years. The thing about it is, he spoke about Valtteri Bottas being an incredible teammate at Mercedes. But George Russell comes in next year to Mercedes, into that seat, and Bottas heads off to Alfa Romeo. Like, George Russell is a driver who can challenge Lewis Hamilton. We could see a trio of Hamilton, Verstappen and Russell challenging for the world title next year, essentially. That's how good I think George Russell is. So all of a sudden, he's got a teammate, not like Valtteri Bottas, who's a great little teammate who helps him out and, you know, keeps Verstappen at bay the odd time. But he's got a teammate now who's challenging him as well, which is probably going to fire a rocket up his ass, to be honest. Lewis Hamilton wants that. At 36 years of age, you need some further motivation to stay in the sport, without a shadow of a doubt. You talk about good teammates, like a word has to be said for Sergio Perez. Checo Perez kept Hamilton at bay, and that's another reason why they won at the weekend. He kept him at bay for a few laps, and extraordinary driving by Checo Perez to do that and kind of hold him up and let Max kind of close down the lead for a bit. Ultimately, under the safety car, it didn't really have much of an impact. But Bottas started P6, Checo Perez started P4, so he had an impact on the race. Bottas didn't. But in terms of the rivalry, Jared, like, Verstappen's going to win multiple world titles. You look at the age profile of the Formula One grid at the minute. You've got, I guess, some of the older guys like Hamilton, like Sebastian Vettel, Bottas as well. Kimi Raikkonen's gone. Fernando Alonso is still there. But really, the curve is heading downwards. You've got George Russell. You've got Max Verstappen, Mick Schumacher. You've got all these drivers coming through who are going to dominate the sport over the next couple of years. This rivalry is not going to last long. It's going to be a year or two, I'd imagine, until Lewis Hamilton hangs up his helmet, or whatever the F1 term for retirement is. I'm looking forward to next year. I think next year is going to be fireworks. But I don't think Hamilton wants to go out this way. You know, he wants to win that 8th world title, and next year is going to be fascinating with George Russell in the other Mercedes seat. And we've seen what George Russell can do in a Williams car. George Russell has got points before in a Williams car. Now, it's on a par with Haas, probably, in terms of the worst car on the grid. And that's what he can do in the worst car on the grid. So stick him into a Mercedes and let's see what he can do.
Plenty of comments coming in, as you can imagine, on this. Shane has said, don't forget the start of the race where Hamilton should have given his position back to Max. Andrew says, looking forward to the courtroom episode of Drive to Survive. And in God We Trust says, so can they only appeal to the organisation itself to look into potential corruption within the organisation? Doesn't sound dodgy at all. Basically, I think In God We Trust wants to see this go all the way to Cass.
It's a fair point. It's a fair point. And the word you mentioned earlier, Owen, manipulated. That's what Hamilton said over the radio. It's the only thing. And if you watch it back now, it is like a Shakespearean drama, that final lap. Everything that happened. So much was happening in such a short space of time. My jaw was on the floor watching it. I didn't know what way to look. And all you hear over the car radio from Hamilton, you obviously hear the Toto Wolff, which John Duggan, by the way, did a stellar impression of a few minutes ago. But the moment where Hamilton just goes, when just before the final turn, when he realizes there's no catching Max Verstappen, he's 2.5 seconds ahead, he just says, "This is manipulated, man." And you can hear the sorrow in his voice. He's like, "This is manipulated." That's how he feels. So if that's how he felt during the race, and he was so dignified and full of decorum after the race, I wonder, was he just biting his tongue a little bit? And we're going to hear what Lewis Hamilton really thinks at some stage in the coming weeks. I think we will. I think Lewis Hamilton is going to finally come out when the dust has settled and he's let Max Verstappen enjoy his victory, because that's what he's doing. He's 36 years of age. He's won 7 world titles. He knows what it's like to win a first world title. In 2008, he did it in the most dramatic of circumstances, just like Max Verstappen. I think what Lewis Hamilton is doing here is standing back, letting Max Verstappen enjoy his moment, not ruining it on him. Let him celebrate and let him have his fun. And then in a few weeks, when the dust has settled, he's going to finally tell us what he really thinks about this decision about the FIA. That's my take anyway. But look, it's just a fascinating finish to what a fascinating season.
We still haven't heard from Wolff, though, have we? In a public setting, he's probably saving the exclusive for someone. He's going to go and sell it to Oprah, and he'll be like, "Screw you, Formula One channels. This is what I'm doing with my exclusive," because that's what we want. That's the final piece in the jigsaw. From my perspective anyway, the appeals are probably all going to be rejected, right? I think that's what we can all accept over the course of the next little while, that the result will stand. But it's just that Toto Wolff interview, which I'm going to be really interested in. That is pretty much it for the Formula 1 reaction to the weekend. We want to keep you on the line there, Shane, because we want to do a mini Deal or No Deal. It's not January yet. We're about halfway through December at this point, but Deal or No Deal will be back in January for a busy month of speculation and absolutely no transfers whatsoever. Chair?
He's a United fan. What do you think? Are you team Ralph?
Ralphie's at the wheel, lads. Ralphie's at the wheel. No, it's going to take him a little bit of time. Two wins, two clean sheets, granted against Palace and Norwich. But I like the cut of his jib. I like the way he talks. It's not like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer post-match interviews where, you know, after a defeat or after a narrow 1-0 win away to Norwich, Solskjaer might say something like, "This is United. We are United. We are, you know, we're doing something here. We have a plan." Solskjaer didn't have a plan. And let's be honest, I still like the guy and I still think he's the best manager since the in the post-Ferguson era that Manchester United have had. But
is he? Rangnick, was he?
Well, low bar. In terms of what he achieved, maybe not the best manager on paper. Jose Mourinho was clearly a better manager than Louis van Gaal.
Van Gaal won the FA Cup.
He did. He did, of course. And look, I say that in the knowledge that Solskjaer didn't win a trophy at United, but in terms of what he created at the club, the signings he brought in, what he did with the younger players as well, and most importantly, the attitude the fans had, starting to enjoy games more. Like, under Mourinho and Van Gaal, it was torturous watching United, not just because of results, but because of performances. And Solskjaer changed that. He changed the way they played. And look, he can't take all the credit for that. I'm sure there's coaching decisions as well behind the scenes. But really, if from an enjoyment perspective, I think he's the best manager United have had in the post-Ferguson era. Well, Rangnick's doing what he's doing so far. It's going to take a little bit of time to bed in, but he's got a seriously, seriously tasty group of fixtures coming up in terms of ease. So
as long as they
he
happen.
Should be winning. Say it again.
As long as the fixtures actually happen, of course.
This is the thing. Yeah, it's hard to know.
One deal to put to you then. In the Netherlands, Frankie de Jong's father has said that the top five clubs in Europe all want his son. Bayern Munich or Manchester United are believed to be interested. However, his dad says either destination could be a hard sell because it's often bad weather there. Should Manchester United sign him?
The bad weather comment, I mean, who's going to have sympathy for these footballers on, you know, the multimillionaire footballers who can't play in bad weather? I think, look, his father's probably just...
Does it not rain a lot in the Netherlands as well?
I'm sure it does. Yeah, you're just off the North Sea there. I'm sure you get a little bit of bad weather. Enough moisture to grow nice flowers anyway in the Netherlands. But like, top five clubs in Europe. So is he saying that Manchester United are one of the top five clubs in Europe? Is that his point? He says the top five clubs in Europe want his son. So I assume he's including United in that.
Yeah,
for some reason. But
it's a nice positive
obviously he's
tint you put on it there.
Like, it's a good signing. Of course, Frankie de Jong is a good signing. I think, and as someone made the point last night, was it Pat Nevin last night, or someone maybe recently making the point that he should probably bring in a load of German players, and that's probably what he's going to do. Like, if anyone's going to know the top players in the Bundesliga that are being unnoticed and underrated, then Ralf Rangnick will. So, look, Frankie de Jong, like, clearly that's a position that United need, but maybe he wants to come and join his mate Donny van de Beek and sit on the bench, because van de Beek was extremely highly rated before he joined United. So if Frankie de Jong is on the phone to Donny van de Beek in any way, shape or form, he will be told to stay well clear of Manchester United, I think. So I'd be surprised if he went to Old Trafford.
Yeah, so would I. Deal or no deal, Ger?
No deal.
No deal. Okay. I see that. I like that little taster. We've probably got you in the appetite now for the January transfer window to slam open on the 1st of January and deal or no
it's
deal.
It's going to be wild. It could be wild. Like, all that Newcastle money sloshing around. Like,
Pogba going.
I mean, they've got to get rid of as many players as they can in this transfer window to give them a nice, clear run at the summer.
Yeah, they certainly will. It's going to be very interesting. Shane, good stuff.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.